let's just pretend that, you know, we're on the train coming back from New York or whatever, and we sit down next to each other randomly, and I say, I'm Jason, I'm Amanda, what do you do?
Let's see.
Got it. You ready?
Yep.
This is the
Doers.
This is the Doers Podcast.
Do it.
I love that you're doing that.
I do what I do.
Conversations with creators,
innovators,
and entrepreneurs from Lancaster and the Central Pennsylvania region.
These are the people who make Central PA a great place
to live, work, and play.
Start again.
I'm Jason Mundock. Today on the program, it's Dr. Amanda Kemp, a racial justice and mindfulness mentor and the founder of Theater for Transformation, a professional performing company that looks to heal the world through the performing arts. Years of intense racial justice advocacy and the need to take a break from touring her Theater for Transformation productions led Amanda to mindfulness practices.
Mindfulness, the tools of self-compassion and mindfulness, gave me a way to stand for racial justice with less wear and tear on my being.
She spent a few years working alongside one of her own racial justice mentors before deciding to break out on her own and become a mentor to others. Her work combines her lifelong experiences as an advocate for inclusion and equality, along with the mindfulness and self-care practices that give her the energy to continue that work. For Amanda, being a mentor to someone is a two-way relationship, walking beside each other and working together.
What I promise you as a mentor is that I'm going to be honest and I'm going to investigate my failure and share them with you. So I'm promising to be constantly learning.
And she offers a variety of resources on her website for you to continue to learn and become involved with a growing movement of those who stand for justice. You can learn all about the important work that Amanda is doing at dramandakemp.com and keep up with her work in the arts at theaterfortransformation.org.
Cool, awesome.
This is the Doers Podcast.
Brought to you by The Candy Factory.
Co-working in Lancaster.
I'm a racial justice and mindfulness mentor. And when I first talked to you 7 years ago, Jason, we were talking about Theater for Transformation.
Yes.
Because I was cultivating my primary identity as an artist.
Right.
And as an artist for social change, right? And as a poet and a theater producer. And so since then, I've pivoted to making racial justice and mindfulness the main thing that I do in terms of earning a living. And I still work with Theater for Transformation. We're still performing and traveling, but to a lesser extent.
I don't often hear those two things together.
Which two things?
Racial justice and mindfulness. So let's pick that apart.
Well, that's exactly it. I put racial justice and mindfulness in the same lane.
Okay.
So typically when we think about mindfulness, it's a way to deal with stress. It kind of, I mean, if I don't know who you picture when you picture mindfulness, but I picture somebody white who's kind of middle class and, you know,
who's
just kind of walking a little bit of a Buddhist thing, right?
There's a stereotype of a woman in white linen pants on the beach with her back to the camera and the sunset.
Oh, got
That's
you.
That's what I always
That's
picture.
That's your mindfulness picture.
And she's white and typically blonde.
Yes.
Right? And yeah, it's like that quintessential stock photo of mindfulness.
Yeah. Okay.
And sort of the you know, the East meets West
right.
thing.
Right. Well, in our case, in my case, mindfulness, the tools of self-compassion and mindfulness gave me a way to stand for racial justice with less wear and tear on my being.
Interesting.
Yes. Because when you stand for racial justice, you're in the midst of, you're immediately in conflict.
Right.
But conflict is wearing. Right? So we live in a society where I am constantly encountering data that rubs me the wrong way, to put it in a brief, right?
Right.
Or that causes me pain or discomfort. And so what self-compassion and mindfulness did, and I put the two together,
right,
is they gave me a way to cultivate ways of being within myself so that that data is less powerful in acting on my system, and so that I'm more mindful, conscious of what data I'm taking in and what I'm expanding on in my thinking.
So does that allow you to disassociate maybe a little bit from the meaning behind that data so that you can see it more objectively? Like to not personalize it? I don't know where
yeah.
I'm kind of going with this. But.
Yeah, well, it... Okay.
I mean, my experience with mindfulness is the... It's the awareness or the acknowledgement of the egoic mind and the stories that the ego creates to satisfy itself, right? So that would be my perception of it. So if I'm going to be more mindful, I'm aware of the story. I'm aware of the thinking or the thoughts that are wearing me down or stressing me out, right, in the case that you're talking about. And because there's an awareness of those thoughts, I am not the thoughts. I am the awareness that knows that the thoughts are happening. Therefore, I can disassociate. And so that's the context of my comment.
Yeah, I understand. So the term disassociation and disassociate, I'm going to not use those words because they, to me, they have other meanings.
Okay.
That are like the opposite of mindfulness. So so you talked about being able to witness or see something and not be the thing that you're witnessing or seeing.
Right.
Okay, yes. So I would agree with that. And for me, mindfulness, the mindfulness that I practice incorporates self-compassion, a very deliberate investigation, not just of my thoughts, which is mindfulness, but of my feelings and of my body sensations. So my emotions and my body sensations, and seeking to give loving care, loving kindness to my nervous system, to my physical body, to the hurt, afraid self that's reactive in the moment. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So when you're experiencing this information, are you open to then experiencing the reaction of that information?
Yes. So because I'm having a reaction.
Right.
So to be self-compassionate with it is to pay attention to it.
Got it.
And to see, is there something that I need? Or is there some way in which I am extending my suffering? Are there expectations I'm having of myself or of other people that are exacerbating the negativity of the situation?
Okay.
You know? So mindful self-compassion is a way to be countercultural. It's a way to cultivate loving kindness inside of myself as I stand for something I call justice.
Got it.
The problem with only standing for justice as I see it is that there's no comfort in there, and our nervous systems can get worn down or distorted because we're always in fight or flight, or we're frozen if we're so to stand in a place of restfulness, to even deliberately cultivate restfulness as a legitimate need and desire for someone who also stands for justice is unusual, which is why you don't hear those two in the same lane. But that's what I'm interested in.
Well, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Let's take that then further to the word mentor.
Yeah.
So it's one thing for you to practice mindfulness and self-compassion when you're dealing with racial justice issues. How then are you mentoring others?
So for me, mentoring, like how I distinguish it from coaching.
Sure.
So you know how in athletics, there's a coach and there's an athlete, and the athlete is on the court or on the ice.
Right.
And the coach is on the side, right? Mentoring is I'm on the court too. I'm also at risk. I am failing as well as succeeding. And what I promise you as a mentor is that I'm going to be honest and I'm going to investigate my failure and share them with you. So I'm promising to be constantly learning.
I see.
And maybe I'm a little bit ahead of you.
Right.
And I think everybody should have somebody who's a little bit ahead of them. But I'm human and I don't pretend to be perfect at that which I am practicing.
Sure, and I understand the difference. It's the senior player. With the sports analogy, it's the quarterback, the veteran quarterback, and the young wide receiver can be mentoring because they're in the game together. They're actually participating together. Whereas the coach is a separate entity.
It really is
playing a different role in that.
Yes.
In that game.
Yeah, it is a little more peer like, And being a mentor is interesting because, so as a profession, to be a mentor means that there's an energetic and a monetary exchange between me and people who want to be mentored by me.
Sure.
But you can also have mentors who don't even know that they're mentoring you because right. you read their books, you listen to all their stuff online, or you go to all their courses. I love having mentors. People who I actively seek out mm-hmm. for their advice, or who I actively follow a little bit, you know.
Yeah. How does one engage with you then from a mentee perspective? Like what are the services that you offer
yeah.
that would allow me to count you as a mentor?
Well, you have to, get in my world, read my book, or, go on to YouTube and check out all those videos. So you can just do it through all the freebie routes.
Sure.
And then if you decide, wow, I want to make a commitment, because the other thing about when I'm your mentor is that it's a mutual commitment.
I see.
So we're committing to each other for 3 to 6 months to really be in a honest and deliberate investigation of your hidden biases or wherever it is that you're stuck.
Mm.
Because the promise of when I work with you is that you're going to have a breakthrough in whatever you have said you want to have a breakthrough in, and that I say, yes, I can help you do that. Once we make that commitment to each other, then we're on the roll. I mean, like we're in a game for a very specific purpose. We want to win Wimbledon.
Got it.
Yeah.
We're all about sports today.
I know. I love it because I'm really, I'm not exactly an athlete.
Neither am I. So is that determined right away? Like if the thing that needs broken through, or is that something that maybe emerges?
Isn't that interesting?
Well, I'll bet that sometimes people think they know what it is, but it turns out to be something completely different.
Yeah.
That would be my guess.
Yeah. So we go in with some specific, like a common goal that people will have when they want me as a mentor, if they're European American, is how do I break out of this white bubble? It's wherever I live or my work or somehow my daily routines, I'm living a segregated life.
Yeah.
So that takes some deliberate thinking, but also a deliberate feeling about how have you unconsciously created this segregation in your life? What were you trying to protect yourself from? Or what had you unconsciously accepted as good or as safe or as ideal or desirable? You see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So in some ways, people say, help me break out of the white bubble. I want to have more relationships, significant, authentic relationships with people of color. But what we first have to get to is, what are those internalized biases that you have that have helped you create your life as it is?
Interesting.
So you got to get through that before you get to the other thing.
This is the Doers Podcast.
Visit us online at coworkinginlancaster.com.
Home of the Candy Factory, a co-working space in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
I'd like to touch on some of your journey, because you mentioned Theater for Transformation, and that's what you were deeply involved with when we met. So if you could share a little bit about what Theater for Transformation is today, and then let's go back and walk the journey to how you got to this point from those days.
Yeah. So Theater for Transformation is a professional performing company. And what we do are performances based on poetry and music. And our themes are historical and contemporary. And by contemporary, I mean we're very concerned with issues of, the killing of unarmed black men and boys by the police, the criminalization of black people as a whole, making black life matter more. We're also concerned with relationships and solidarity across race lines, especially with other people of color and with struggles for our environment and stuff like that. So that's where we are right now. And in that ensemble, my now husband, who's European American, who's a violinist, who's trained in a whole European, Western concert
right.
music tradition, a saxophonist who's Chinese American, based in Chinatown in San Francisco, who comes out of a jazz training and what he calls a black music vernacular, and his own Chinese American cultural heritage. And our drummer, who is a West African master drummer from Liberia, who's a woman who had to fight to play the drum rather than play the instruments that were thought to be fit for women.
Wow.
So that's like the core
right.
of that ensemble. So as you can hear in that, a lot of musicians, and then Amanda, who's out there as a spoken word artist.
It's a great melting pot.
It is.
I mean, that is just, you know, such a diverse cast.
And diverse traditions. And our focus still is on telling African-American stories.
Got it.
But we're interested in how African-American stories intersect with other stories. So, for example, one of the pieces that we did was called I Remember Tiananmen 1989, which is about the uprising in Tiananmen Square. And here we are on the anniversary of the People's Republic of China. So back in 1989, like 100,000 people occupied that square until they were removed by armies, troops, and tanks.
Right, that iconic image of the tank.
Right, and the one man with the shopping bags in his hand standing in front of them dancing. I call it dancing. So I wrote a poem about that because the students there held signs that said, "We shall overcome." So they were connecting their movement to the Black Freedom Movement. So the poem I wrote, I Remember Tiananmen 1989, was saying that I remember this, even though it's not in the official history of China. Like, it's not in their official history, except maybe in Hong Kong. I remember. And I remember that you wore T-shirts saying, "We shall overcome," that you wanted to connect it with me.
Yeah.
And the movement that I'm a product of. And then musically, what happens in that piece is, and this is really Francis Wong's creation, he has the spiritual We Shall Overcome intersecting with this very Chinese patriotic song called, you know, The Flag of Bloodstained Glory. But he's put it in a whole jazz vernacular, so it's like this crazy mix of traditions and sounds. And what we're doing with that is trying to show that the African-American, you know, spirituals, the Black freedom struggle has affected people all over the world.
Right. That's awesome.
It is. So that's the kind of thing we do now in our current incarnation.
So I know that was a really big part of your life going back a few years. So talk me through the pivot to the racial justice mentoring from Theater for Transformation. How did you make that connection or that leap?
I made the connection by, it was like forced, I would say. So before we moved into our current iteration, which is poetry and music, which is like far simpler to produce than a play.
Absolutely.
Plays are, they take years of cultivation, you know, and they're complex things to produce, to tour, and they're super labor intensive. And you have to be in the same room together to produce, to create a play, you know?
Yes.
And basically I got burnt out.
Okay, that's fair.
Doing all the art, the producing, the fundraising, you know, performing on stage more times than not, and trying to build an organization.
Yeah.
It was just, I just got tired.
It's not the most efficient medium.
No.
To get the point across. I don't know how else to say that. It's a ton of work.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, an audience is going to come and enjoy it.
Yes.
Versus poetry and music, which is much easier and lighter to produce, and the audience is going to come and enjoy it.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? At the end of those two productions, the audience is just simply going to enjoy it and walk away and hopefully take something from it.
Yes.
So it was time to move on. It was time to do something different.
It was time to do it differently. But I had to step away from the organization completely.
Yeah.
So I stopped serving on the board. I no longer participated in his productions. And actually the organization was about to close. And then the then board chair called me back to say, you know, in deference to you, Amanda, since you founded this, would you like to come back and create a new board around it and revive it? And I thought about it for a couple months, and then I decided, yes, but I would do it completely differently.
Yeah.
So basically, when I pulled away from the organization, which I had devoted like 5 or 6 years of my life to, it was like my third child, I grieved. and I was asked to help someone who had created her own startup around racial justice and inclusion in New Haven, Connecticut. She had always been my mentor. She'd always been appreciative of me in the various workshops and whatnot, and she asked me to come on board. And so after working with her for a few years, I decided that I would do my own thing.
Oh, okay.
And then Theater for Transformation wouldn't be a main source of my income, but it would be this artistic outlet.
This is the Doers Podcast, conversations with
creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs
from all around Central Pennsylvania.
I'm Jason Mundock, talking today with Dr. Amanda Kemp, a racial justice and mindfulness mentor based here in Lancaster.
I want to hear some examples of the impact of the work that you've done as a racial justice and mindfulness mentor specifically.
So I want to tell you about someone who came to me. This is an older European American woman who came to me distraught, exhausted, despairing. She was part of a SURGE, which is Stand Up for Racial Justice, in her community. She'd been doing Black Lives Matters vigils. And she was very, she felt very spiritually like compelled to take a stand, right? But the problem was that she was completely getting toasted. You know, there was a lot of opposition in her town in New England. And she was like on 24/7 because of something, you know, there had been an incident. And so there's a lot of media coverage. And she was the person on. And she said to me, "I'm so exhausted, but I feel so guilty, Amanda, because I know people of color can never take a break. So I'm not going to take a break." And I said, "Okay, hold up." I said, "I recommend that people of color take a break. And I recommend that you take a break. And by taking a break, I don't mean, you know, zone out and watch, I don't know, 90s TV. I actually mean take care of yourself.
Right.
Do those things that are going to feed you. It is okay to pause, to not take that email right away, that phone call, to put some, to pace yourself through this." And so this person, I think, first came to me maybe 3 years ago. And today, you know, she's running her own workshops. She's being asked to speak. And she's happy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is someone who smiles. The last time I talked to her, you know, it's like, I don't know what happened. But we could see each other visually via Zoom. And I was like, "You look good." She's like, "I feel good."
That's fantastic.
It is. It is.
That's the oxygen mask, right?
Yes.
It's the old, you got to put yours on first. You can't help the person next to you if you can't breathe.
Right. And who's going to want to be in your revolution if they can't dance?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Am I going to want to be, if I end up looking like you, you know, I won't be going to all the meetings.
Right.
You know? So we have to be that change that we want to see. And by being that, I don't mean we have to just be anti-racist or we have to be, you know, coming from a liberation standpoint. What I mean is, let's break that down. Do we want kindness? Do we want human connection? Do we want to be seen and loved for who we are, even with our imperfections? If we want to see that in the society we're building, then we it starts with us practicing it, because we're constantly planting seeds for what the future is and what we do right now.
Yeah.
So someone else who came to me was an introvert. And she told me she was in a class and she was like, "You probably will never hear me speak in this class because I'm an introvert. It's nothing personal." And soon after, she started speaking up in the class. And then she sent me an email and she said, "I just have to let you know, I've been practicing this thing you called holding space for transformation in the classroom. And recently," she's a college professor, English. She said, "Recently, I decided to show the film Moonlighting. Even though I was afraid to, because it has huge, very strong themes about racism, you know, poverty, masculinity, all kinds of stuff is going on. Sexual orientation. It's just a lot in that film, you know." Uh-huh. And of course, it won an Academy Award. So... But she said, I wasn't going to show it, but after taking your class, I had the courage to show it because you gave me this tool of how to hold space for transformation. So it gave her a way to be in her classroom and a way to communicate with her students to create an environment where people felt safe, to say what they were experiencing.
Interesting. Can you expound on this?
What tool? Holding space for transformation?
Yeah.
So one of my mentors, Neo Nussbaum, introduced me to it. It's a practice of being unconditional love and unconditional acceptance. So it's a practice of a way of being.
Okay.
So most of us don't know how we're being.
Right.
We're just being, and all of a sudden people are like, why are you so grumpy today? Or was I being grumpy? You don't know what you're being a lot of times. When you hold space for transformation, you're deliberately being, cultivating inside of yourself or allowing to flow through you unconditional love and unconditional acceptance. And when you be like that, people tend to open up.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And when you be like that, you give yourself permission to take chances.
If someone is practicing that, how does that translate to your example where maybe I'm in a situation where I'm afraid to do something or I'm afraid to show this thing? How does that work?
So there's a free meditation that I have and that she was practicing on her own prior to stepping into the classroom.
Uh-huh.
Because to get into a being of unconditional love and unconditional acceptance is fairly unusual. In our society.
Absolutely.
You know, we're very critical.
Especially today.
Yeah.
When we're more divisive than ever.
Yes. And we're also very critical. We're trained to be, as if you're in academia, you're trained to be critical. What's wrong? What's wrong? What's insufficient?
Yeah.
So anyway, being unconditional love and unconditional acceptance takes some practice. I would say practice with yourself first at home before you try to take it out in public.
Sounds like a good idea.
So it's all about getting your feet on the ground. Getting connected to your breath. And for some of us, it could be putting a hand on your heart center and noticing the beat of the heart. Really feeling for it. And then making the declaration or inviting in, I am unconditional love. I am unconditional acceptance. And I just repeat that a few times to myself with the awareness of my feet on the ground. With the awareness of my breath. And I just made myself ready to be with you in a whole different way. I've slowed everything down, and it's like there's a little smile inside of me. So when you go into a classroom like that and you say, we're going to see this great film today. And when you watch this film, I want you to watch for this. And then we're going to discuss it. And here's how we're going to discuss it. Each person's going to have a chance to think about what they really feel and what they think. And then we're going to listen to each other. And I really want us to listen to each other with respect.
So you're coming from a space,
yes.
Right? You're building
yes.
an environment.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Yes. Yes, yes. You're very deliberately dealing with the energy in your room.
Mm-hmm.
So she's at the college level. Someone from an elementary school in York used it before her elementary kids came in every day, and she greeted each kid at the door, deliberately holding space for transformation.
Wow.
As each kid. You know what I mean?
It's huge, right?
Yes. So in her case, she said that students were amazingly sensitive to each other, and she had three male students of color share very vulnerable stuff, and they had never spoken,
wow.
you know, in the class before, but they felt like, you know, the space was good for them. So those are just a couple.
It's so easy to forget the intentionality of the energy that you're contributing to wherever you are and the reciprocity of that.
Mm.
It's so easy to just forget it, just to not understand that. That's really fascinating.
And it is a doing. Some people say to me, what can I do? What can I do?
That's it,
like
yeah.
If you're someone who gets freaked out when conversations about racism come up, you know, a lot of people reach out to me about that, like they freeze, and I tell them, breathe, get connected to your feet, you know, get back in your body. Because when we freak out, literally, we go out of our bodies.
Right.
And there's no power there. There's no power there. It's when you come back in and you're connected to yourself, you actually have the power to make a connection with someone else.
What's the future impact of your work?
Well, I think the future impact is that we have this this collective of racial justice and mindfulness mentors. And I call my program Racial Justice from the Heart. So all these racial justice from the heart facilitators, teachers, and mentors who are working in their communities.
Got it.
And what I really want to do is bring those people who have signed up for that kind of role, bring them together, you know, every 6 months, every year, somewhere really beautiful, so we can nourish ourselves by the water and eat really good food and, yeah, I don't
recharge,
know. Recharge, right? Yeah, have a good time artistically, you know, and then go back out and stand in this unusual place of compassion and justice.
It's great work you're doing.
Thank you.
And it's amazing to watch you evolve. It's
yes.
been great. I wish you all the best. And thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to share this with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. And thanks. What a great idea for a podcast. Doers.
Doers. Do it.
Yes.
The Doers Podcast is produced by Jason Mundock at the Candy Factory,
a co-working space located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Find links and show notes for this podcast and all of our episodes online
at the Candy Factory website,
coworkinginlancaster.com.
Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts.
And keep on doing.
Keep on doing.
Keep on doing.
What you love to do.
This is going to be such a success.
Hey friends, Jason Mundock here. All of the voices in our intro and outro are actually Candy Factory members.
Wait, what?
It's a great community, and yes, we have a good time because frankly, work doesn't have to suck. And we all know that working alone does suck. So if you're a freelancer, entrepreneur, remote worker, or even a student here in Central PA, check out coworkinginlancaster.com and consider joining us at the Candy Factory, an awesome co-working space in Lancaster. Starting at just $50 a month.
Oh, yeah.
That's for a community membership. You can meet other doers in a super creative and collaborative space, tap into business resources to help you get your job done efficiently, and learn all kinds of new and inspiring stuff through our network of really smart people, i.e., our members and guests. We even have a podcast club for members who want to make their own.
Wink, wink.
There's a membership level for everyone, so don't hesitate. Check it all out at coworkinginlancaster.com. Do it.
Do it.